I'm Christopher Lighton with the journalist Mark Danner, who, like almost nobody else out there, has covered one of the dirtiest stories on earth, torture, with an insistent lack of squeamishness about the injuries to human bodies and to American identity. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. The best of Mark Danner's work on politics, violence, and war is now gathered in a book titled Stripping Bare the Body. In Boston this week, Mark Danner sat and talked with me about these years of suspended rules, prolonged detentions, foreign renditions of terror suspects, and torture. This state of exception, as he calls it, and what it's done to our country.
Mark Danner, it occurs to me suddenly that the last time we spoke for broadcast was immediately after the death of the late, great David Halberstam, and you recounted his literally last supper in Berkeley with you and Sandy Tolan and Orville Schell, as I remember. Your own journalism in this marvelous compilation, Stripping Bare the Body, keeps reminding me that we have no scorecard, we have no balance sheet for asymmetrical warfare, which is warfare since 9/11. I'm wondering if you could invent one. I mean, we will have spent something, we Americans, something in the neighborhood of $2 trillion on Iraq, avenging an attack for which Osama bin Laden spent maybe $500,000 to recruit and feed and train the perpetrators of 9/11. By my arithmetic, that's a 4 million to 1 asymmetry of costs. And of course, Osama bin Laden is still out there. But that's just money. Americans are still being told to hold out for a win or success in Afghanistan. And yet this is a war between drones and suicide bombers and IEDs and wedding parties shot up by our own blind arrows. Every day in this war is morally abhorrent, and it's a defeat in that sense for all of us. I want to know how you would sum up this long 8-year ordeal. What have we won? What have we lost?
You've offered the single abstract scorecard, which is money. And of course, even though the United States has spent a fantastic amount, and Al-Qaeda and other associated jihadist groups have spent very little, I don't think that's the most important scorecard. The most important one is political, because after all, this war is about politics. It's not about killing the last jihadist, which will never happen. It's about creating a situation in which the incentive is for fewer jihadists to be created. And probably the part of the scorecard in which the United States shows itself the worst over the last 8 years is having taken actions, the most obvious of which, but not the only one, was the invasion and occupation of Iraq, a major Arab country, that turned a great many Muslim men, usually young Muslim men, educated but unemployed, against the United States, and made them more determined to do something to, in a sense, free their countries from the humiliation of being, in some sense, under the power of the United States. And that isn't simply the occupation of Iraq, of course. We're talking also about the images from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And some of those images, for example, the one of Lindy England holding the leash in military fatigues, this American woman holding the leash around the neck of the naked Arab man lying on the ground, his face clenched in humiliation and pain, which seems to concretize Osama bin Laden's picture of the United States, which is an imperialistic power that suppresses and humiliates and destroys Muslims. And in a sense, part of the job of the U.S. over the last 8 years was somehow to reduce that image and cause there to be fewer jihadists created, to create a political world in which you would see less of them, not more. And in that sense, I think the Bush administration and George W. Bush was a gift to Osama bin Laden and to the movement that he led. You know, fighting a political war, it's a very hard thing, because how do you tell Americans what will it mean to win? How do you actually win? And how do you fight these people? And one way you fight them is politically. And in a sense, the Bush administration had a rather crooked idea of that. That is, we need to start a democracy in Iraq, supposedly, which would, in the words of Condoleezza Rice, convince Arab men that they no longer needed to drive airplanes into buildings in Washington and New York. The problem is that the political effect, whatever they thought it would be, was absolutely the opposite of an imperialist America suppressing Muslims and occupying a major Muslim country. So I think Obama has started to try to reverse this. His speech in Cairo was one effort. I think he's very conscious of the need to shift the political reality about the United States and its relations with Muslims. But the damage has been very, very great. There is a sense in which George W. Bush stepped into the caricature that Osama bin Laden created of him and created of the United States. And making a difference in that, turning that around, is a very, very hard job. It won't be, it will take a long time.
Can you imagine a way of going about it if President Obama accepted your terms, that this is a political war and winning has almost nothing to do with killing people? What would he do?
I think he's begun to do something, and that is speak clearly to the Muslim world in terms of respect, quoting the Quran, which he did very effectively in Cairo, setting out American values in clear terms, and perhaps in not hypocritical terms, which is how Bush was perceived. I think there is, as your question implies, a paradox at the heart of this, because the United States, in policy terms, this isn't just atmospherics, the United States is the major supporter of the Mubarak regime in Egypt, and a very horrible autocracy, and the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. And there is a reason that Osama bin Laden's himself and his forces attack the United States. And it isn't simply that they, quote, attack or hate our freedoms. It's that they perceive the U.S. in policy terms to be supporting regimes that are autocratic and, in their terms, apostate. They're not true Muslim regimes. And the policy problem from Obama's point of view is, how do you encourage political modernization and political liberalization in Egypt, for example? And that's an extremely hard problem, not least because an election, free election in Egypt, would probably see the Muslim Brotherhood in some form come to power. And that's a difficult thing for the United States to countenance. We saw similar attitudes during the 50s, during the Cold War, when in Guatemala you had the Arbenz regime, a leftist regime, not a communist one, elected, and the U.S. responded by overthrowing it. But the problems are very similar. That is, how do you encourage political liberalization in a way that you think is not detrimental to American interests? And possibly the way to begin is to conceive American interests in a somewhat broader frame, in a somewhat less ideological frame.
But what would you do in Afghanistan, where he is deliberately reconsidering everything, presumably?
Well, I think he's doing the first thing you need to do, which is actually to try not to be bound by past choices. I think he's actually showing an ability to think and to be seen to be thinking and consulting people and trying to make a reasoned decision, which after gathering relevant information, which the last administration shied away from completely, it put forward an idea of certainty. And I don't mind that the president is looking into this and isn't sure. I think Afghanistan, having said that, is an extremely difficult situation. It's, you know, there's an insurgency on the ground that in which the U.S. is supporting a government that's quite unpopular, that is losing. That is where we are now. And that insurgency, in a sense, is an epiphenomenon, as politicians or political scientists say, of a larger conflict between India and Pakistan. And you have a Taliban force that at once is being supported by the Pakistanis, the U.S., major U.S. ally, to which it is giving billions of dollars. It is being supported by the Pakistani government and intelligence services. And at the same time, part of that movement is trying to overthrow the Pakistani government itself. It's impossible to conceive a more complicated situation than that confronting the administration in Afghanistan. Having said all that, I'm encouraged by the fact that he is digging his heels in. There's a sense in which there's a relevance here, perhaps, to the Bay of Pigs, in which Kennedy was, I mean, it's not completely parallel, but Kennedy carried on a policy and strengthened it that was in place when he took office and was humiliated, was confronted with a humiliating failure. Obama, having come into office determined to increase troops, did so, but now is pausing. My personal belief is that the way to have a policy in Afghanistan that serves U.S. interests is not to increase troop levels. I think that the unbalance, every additional soldier that goes in there brings with him a detrimental side when it comes to Afghani nationalism that outweighs his utility. Having said that, it looks, when we're talking here, that the president is going to choose some kind of middle road. That is, it'll be a political choice of perhaps sending a few more, but not sending as many as the generals want. He's in a very difficult situation. I don't think there's any, you know, one of the ironies of it when we talk about asymmetric warfare is that deep involvement on the ground in Afghanistan is precisely what Osama bin Laden wanted when he attacked the United States on September 11th, 2001. 8 years ago, he thought, and there's a lot of evidence of this, that what would happen is the United States would invade Afghanistan, get mired on the ground in a ground war as the Soviet Union had before it, and would be destroyed, in their thinking, just as the Soviet Union was. They would be able to destroy the remaining superpower by drawing it into an Afghan trap. That's why they killed Ahmad Shah Massoud just before the attack. This was clearly what they wanted. The Pentagon avoided it. They didn't. Rumsfeld's Pentagon didn't want to go in heavy on the ground, and they were looking at Iraq. So it's an irony that some who encouraged the attack on Iraq to begin with are now encouraging, particularly on the Republican side, but not only, a heavy ground involvement in Afghanistan, which I think holds extremely significant risks. And I think he's very nervous about it, and rightly so.
What do we know about fighting an asymmetrical enemy? Do we know anything at all, really, about countering their leverage?
It's a fascinating question. The U.S. finally, in Vietnam, learned a good deal about fighting an asymmetric enemy, as the French had before it in Indochina and Algeria, as the British had in Malaya, as it was then called. The United States eventually, by the time it ended the Vietnam involvement, had learned a great deal about fighting a counterinsurgency. I remember encountering a young major in Iraq in 2003, who turned out to be an expert on counterinsurgency, who was at a military base near Ramadi. And he said to me, you know, the key problem here is that after Vietnam, we took everything we knew about counterinsurgency and burned it. The American army didn't want to think about it. They didn't want to study it. They just didn't want to think about doing it again. They went back to major tank warfare of the sort that would have to be conducted in the central plains of Germany in the event of war with the Soviet Union. So we forgot everything we knew. And in effect, in Iraq, we had to learn it all over again. And suddenly it became an area where people would be promoted, officers would be promoted if they knew this. The major I met, you know, is now a colonel. And it hadn't been that way up to now. The problem is that the other side, while we've finally been learning at the cost of 4,000 lives in Iraq, the other side has really been learning. The asymmetric warfare that was learned and perfected in Iraq involving suicide bombers of all kinds, bicycle bombers, truck bombers, car bombers, bombers on foot, you name it, deployed in combinations of bewildering complexity, the improvised explosive devices that grew larger and larger, placed under streets, blowing up armored vehicles. All of these things became perfected and comprised a kind of insurgent's toolkit that now you're seeing deployed with great effectiveness in Afghanistan. So the soldiers I spent time with in Iraq were very conscious that the T TTPs, as they call them, as the military calls them, tactics, techniques, and procedures. The delta of the TTPs, the change in techniques, tactics, and procedures, was very fast on the insurgent side. And this last 8 years has been a kind of vast university education for the world's insurgency that was carried out in Iraq that you're now seeing in a postgraduate phase in Afghanistan. And the American army has not kept up, because these wars are political. They involve not just the bang-bang, but the talk-talk, as Mao called it. You have to have a political program and a legitimate government with whom to deal on the ground in order to win. And we see that problem in spades in Afghanistan, as we saw it in South Vietnam.
I'd love you to make up your own scorecard, Mark Danner, out of thin air, but of what you've learned about what you could conclude we have won and what we have lost in this very, very unconventional confrontation. Give us your own rundown, column A, column B, column C, if you like, on asymmetrical warfare. What happened in the last 8 years out there?
I think, in particular, the American military has learned how to operate on the ground, how to get out of its armored vehicles, how to walk the streets, the importance of learning a neighborhood, the importance of knowing that the people you meet in your AOR, area of responsibility, are the very people who may or may not give money to the insurgents who are trying to kill you. The importance of knowing that if you establish associations with those people, maybe they won't give them money, and maybe even they will tip you off the next time you come through and tell you where that improvised explosive device is that otherwise is going to blow up your armored vehicle and take your legs away. And I think they have learned that lesson very strongly. I think there's parts of the American military have learned about the difficulties of counterinsurgency, the political delicacy required, and many other things that they had forgotten, certainly since Vietnam and before. On the other side, that's the plus side in military terms. The minus side in military terms is not only the deaths, but also a military that's been stretched to the breaking point for years. We have an officer corps that's been depleted by too much deployment, by people, by families breaking up. We have a lower standard of who gets in the military by the sheer need to keep these places full. We have exhaustion of vehicles and other technology and other equipment. The American military, I think, is not in great shape. I think, though, the greater stakes have been political. I think the U.S., over the last 8 years, did itself a great deal of damage, both in its profile as a unilateral imperial power, which is the profile that Osama bin Laden sketched of the United States, and which was a profile that George W. Bush was very happy, apparently, to occupy completely. And I think that damage was very significant. And the damage of the pictures from Abu Ghraib, from Guantanamo, the idea of American hypocrisy, its professing human rights at the very same time as it violated them habitually, the long-term imprisonment of Muslims in Guantanamo, Bagram, and other places, 6-7 years without trial of any kind. All of that is very vividly known throughout the Muslim world. And its political importance, I think, is very little appreciated by Americans. You see murals of the pictures from Abu Ghraib. These are real things that actually cause people, many times people who've been to university but can't find jobs, young men who are frustrated. It really does lead to them making decisions about their future that has to do with joining insurgencies. And I think that is damage that it will take a long time to make up, political damage that you can't just correct by making a speech, although I think Obama has gone some way in making that speech. But it has to be changed in policy terms as well. The problem is when you get to policy terms, things get complicated. When you get to Cairo and Riyadh, things are not so easy. There's a long history that a creative approach to what America means and what it stands for and who it should be supporting and what it can bear and still project its interests, these things perhaps have to be rethought. And this administration hasn't begun to do that.
Mark Danner, I'm reading David Rhodes'
epic accounts of his imprisonment by the Taliban in the New York Times every day for the last week. And I keep wondering, when will we learn that our presence, our mere presence, not to say military, not to say blowing up weddings, etc., is a main generator of the insurgency?
Well, David Rode, in his account of his captivity, which is fascinating, I think explicitly says that. There are people who come and express their anger. We're talking about members of the Taliban who express their anger as a main part of their indictment of the United States, the people who've been imprisoned in Guantanamo indefinitely, and Bagram and Abu Ghraib. This is a major theme in his writing and a major theme in what he hears, the grievances he hears from the Taliban. This does not mean that American policy should be guided solely by what our enemies don't like. That much is obvious. It does mean that there are very significant costs, political costs, to some of these policies that have to be weighed against how useful they are and whether they really protect the country. And we seem to have had a great deal of trouble weighing those costs because, indeed, they're not quantifiable as dollars or anything else. But if you read these accounts, and not just in David Rhodes' account, but other accounts of the Taliban and these insurgents, the images of American power and American hypocrisy when it comes to detention, interrogation, projecting its power are very vivid and very powerful. And this isn't just a propaganda matter. It has to do with policy. It has to do with winning, as John Arquilla, the writer on networking, calls it, the battle of the story. And the battle of the story during the previous administration was something that they gave to Karen Hughes or some other official in the State Department and sent them off to the Middle East to say, you know, make the case for the administration. But you can't make the case when you're occupying Iraq and fighting an insurgency there that shows up on the television sets throughout the Arab world every day. It can't simply be a matter of propaganda. It has to be. It has to have more content than that. And I think we've learned that absolutely in the last 8 years.
Your book keeps raising the question of what is power in a world where an IED that may represent a few $100 worth of effort can blow up a multimillion-dollar tank, and it happens all the time.
Absolutely. You know, I remember distinctly finding an IED when I was with some troops in Dora in southern Baghdad. And, you know, this thing, when we finally were able to get it out of the plastic bag, it was disguised as just a bit of garbage on the street, was as simple as you can imagine. It was a little mortar shell, you know, a few pounds. Millions of them literally are around Iraq. Saddam bought millions of these things that had been duct taped to the base of a phone. You know, the kind of mobile phone you have in your house, and you can press a button on it that will beep the handset if you lose it. That was what was taped to the mortar shell, and an insurgent would stand up in a building, take the handset, and beep it, and that would blow this thing up. Simple as can be. Easy as can be to make it, probably cost a couple $100, depending how you value the mortar shell. And these things have been incredibly effective. You know, you cannot stop all of the IEDs, every IED from being made. You cannot stop that. You have to, at some point, stop the people from wanting to make them. You won't succeed in stopping all of them, but you might succeed in stopping most of them. And it is one thing that I think Americans have learned in the last 8 years, that the road toward killing every jihadist is not the road that the United States has to take. It has to be. It has to be more political, and that's not simply a matter of money. That's a matter of effectiveness. And you know, we read every day about these drone attacks. Another theme in the pieces by David Rode in the New York Times, when he was imprisoned by the Taliban, was the extreme anger caused by the civilian deaths. That are a side effect and a direct effect of using these missiles to attack targets on the ground in parts of Pakistan. And we think this is surgical warfare, but in fact it is people standing on the ground suddenly being blown up and blaming this directly, as of course they will, on the United States. So these things do have a political cost. There's no way to back away from that. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing all of it. It does mean that we should be weighing it, I think, much more directly.
Don't we all
sense at some level that a drone is just another version of airliners attacking the Trade Center, except there's nobody in the Little Devils.
Well, it's an interesting thing to me that, and this is, I think, you know, this book, Stripping Bare the Body, is about a lot of different wars. But one thing that is consistent is people, when they see deaths in their society, feel them very vitally, very horribly. And very often when they see deaths in other societies, particularly if they come surgically from the sky, if they're caused by fighter planes or bombers or drones, those deaths just become numbers. It's interesting that the Associated Press, after the beginning of the Iraq War, did a hospital count of the number of civilian victims, not military, but civilian deaths in Iraq in those first few weeks of the occupation. And the number they come up with, which of course was quite low since they were just counting hospital deaths, many people died at home and didn't go to the hospital, was 3,400. So 3,400 Iraqi civilians, not military, died in those first few weeks of the occupation. That's more than died on 9/11. And of course, Iraq is an 11th the size in population of the United States. It would be equivalent of 40,000 deaths in the United States. It's a lot of dead people, a lot of dead civilians. And I think, in general, we simply don't think about those, particularly when they're caused from airplanes. We simply don't think about it. The problem is, and we you know, if we don't think about it, we don't think about it. But the fact is that the political effects of such things are real. It's people being killed and people blaming it on those who did the killing. It would help us to be smarter about what we did in policy terms, certainly, if we thought about it a little bit more.
Mark, say a word about your title, Stripping Bare the Body. The reference is also to torture, and part of the moral that you write is that the body we've stripped bare is our own. Spell that out.
Well, the title, Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, comes originally from a quote from an ex-Haitian president who was overthrown in a military coup, and he said, you know, political violence is like stripping bare the social body. The better to place the stethoscope and hear the life beneath the skin. That is, when we see societies in convulsions of violence, coup d'etat, revolution, social upheaval, war of various kinds, we really see into the anatomy, into the guts of the society. We understand how it works, differences in wars between classes, between sectarian groups, and so on. And I saw this in Haiti, which the book treats, in the Balkans, the genocide there, in Iraq, in my reporting there, in the War on Terror. And finally, of course, in looking at our own society and the decisions that we've made over the last 8 years or so when it comes to interrogation, when it comes to surveillance, warrantless wiretapping, and when it comes above all to torture. And indeed, a significant theme, at least of the last part of the book, is the way those decisions, which loom over us, have stripped bare what we think is important and what we're willing to do to keep ourselves safe.
Mark, you've been the conscience of journalism on torture most especially. Thank you for Stripping Bare the Body, and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be here. It's a pleasure.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Mark Danner on the themes of his new book, Stripping Bare the Body. Post your own thoughts on asymmetrical warfare, on terrorism, on torture, Afghanistan, all the post-9/11 issues as you feel them, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for joining the conversation.